This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. This summer, along with much of the rest of the country, we're spending some time thinking about systemic racism, what it looks like, the ways we've noticed it in our lives, the ways that we sometimes have overlooked it in our lives. This week, we're talking about education and kids. And today we wanted to get to a truth that you don't have to tell families of color in America, and that's that boys and girls in these families, and most frequently black boys and girls, are often perceived as somehow older than their actual ages, somehow more irresponsible, sometimes less emotionally mature, and ultimately more threatening than white kids in the same age group. Writer and Michigander Des Cooper has some thoughts on this. She lives in Virginia Beach these days looking after her folks, but she wrote an essay recently in The Rumpus that illuminates her family's particular experience. Joining us from Virginia Beach, Des Cooper, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate your being here today.
The article that you wrote is called Arrest Record, and it lays out a particularly harrowing experience you had with your son, Jay, when I think he was about 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Will you read for us?
Sure, I'd be glad to. In the years before Netflix, my husband and I used to take our son and daughter to Blockbuster on Friday nights to rent a movie for the weekend. It became our family ritual, especially in the winter months when the Michigan evenings fell so early. We drive to suburban Detroit. There were no Blockbusters in the city in those days. Grab a movie and then go out for dinner. Increasingly, what started out as a pit stop to launch the weekend became a tug-of-war at the checkout. Instead of heading for the rows of movies, our elementary schooler swarmed the junk aisle, begging for everything except movies. Disney tie-in toys, candy, magazines. Well, one evening, when our son Jay was about 10, he was adamant about getting an action figure. When we told him to put it back and get a movie, he tried to bargain for a toy instead of a movie. We held the line. He glumly picked out a movie, and we headed for the car. As soon as we got outside, he started to giggle, and then he pulled out the action figure from beneath his coat. Now, there's a theory about black parenting. They say that we punish our children harder, louder, more physically than non-black parents as a remnant of slavery. It's like broken windows parenting. You come down hard on the small infractions to prevent bigger infractions that could become a matter of life or death. I don't know how true that is, but we did make a giant mountain out of a molehill that evening. We yelled at Jay for shoplifting and fumed that he had purposely disobeyed us. It was time for a lesson. We marched him back into the store to return the toy and to apologize to the owner for what he'd done. He was big for his age and too big for this kind of behavior, but he started to cry. Ignoring his tears, we asked for the manager, a middle-aged white man. In between his teary gulps, Jay confessed to his crime. "We are so sorry," I said, heaping on the apologies. "This will definitely never happen again." The manager glared at us. "I'm calling the police," he said, picking up the phone. "Wait, what?" My husband stepped toward him. "What are you doing?" "I'm calling the police. He was shoplifting." We hustled out of the store and piled into the car, not hanging around to see if the man actually called the police. My husband and I kept checking the rearview mirror, expecting the wail of a siren at any moment. We tried to console our traumatized child. In the process of teaching him about justice, we'd almost gotten him arrested.
That's Des Cooper reading from her essay, Arrest Record. You can read the entirety of it online at The Rumpus right now. Des Cooper, there's just so much there for really any parent to latch onto and be completely grieved by. What in the world do you think that Blockbuster manager was thinking?
Oh, well, you know, part of me wants to say you need to ask him, like be cocky. But I know exactly what he's thinking. He had seen all of the reports of how black men were rampaging in Detroit and how dangerous blacks were. He had completely absorbed all the stereotypes. And what makes it very interesting for black families is that we realize very often we are reminded that we aren't different than a stereotype. Like sometimes people feel like they've risen above their circumstances or the circumstances in their communities. I have a friend who is an attorney for ExxonMobil in Houston. And in recent times, he's had white coworkers come to him and say, man, you know, this is crazy what's happening out here. It's a good thing that's never happened to you. And he's like, what do you mean? Yeah, that happened to me.
Is there a question mark at the end of that sentence?
No question. Yeah. It's like, and I do think that people feel that sometimes their blacks are honorary whites. Like, those blacks do that, but my blacks don't do that. The ones that go to church or the ones with me or the ones that live next to me or the ones that work or who are my best friend. But the world does not make that distinction. And I think that that's exactly what was happening. And not only were we all caught up, I mean, come on, the parents brought the child back into the store and made the child apologize. There is no way that this kid was not in a supervised, loving environment, trying to teach him moral lessons. And that manager could not see a family striving to raise their child right. All they could see was an inevitableness of that child going astray and becoming a criminal. That's all he could see.
It's hard to imagine that essay capturing even more emotional resonance, but you go right ahead and do that as you continue to talk about, you know, maybe what Jay took away from that situation and how he came to understand himself as the object of so much animus as really just a boy. And you go on to write about a photo shoot you were a part of that involved Jay and a pair of handcuffs that really rocked you both emotionally. Do you mind telling us about that?
Well, this was, you know, not many years apart from, or months even, from when the shoplifting episode happened. Nathaniel Abraham was a sort of a notorious criminal, quote unquote, in the Detroit metro area. He's a Pontiac boy who shot a teenager and was charged as an adult for murder at the age of 11. It was at a time where the United States was afraid of the super predator, the wave of black and brown boys in particular who were going to rampage across the country and make the world unsafe for all of us. And so there was a lot of punk prisons, of mandatory sentencing, and the lowering and lowering and lowering of ages where young people could be treated as an adult for a crime. And Nate was the first to be charged under this law in Michigan. I was working at the Metro Times at that point and was caught up in the story, especially because Nate and my son were a year apart in age. And I just had a hard time imagining this happening to my child. And of course, as a Black mother, I could and almost had to imagine that. While other people would say that would never be mine, I had to say, what if it were mine? When I did the story, we did the photo shoot, and I was clear that I wanted a young Black boy in handcuffs holding a teddy bear on the cover. Like, this is the image I had. But what Black mother could I ask to borrow their son to shoot that? I mean, I could not go to anybody and do that. So we talked about it and decided that Jay could do the shoot. And at first, Jay, this is also sort of the early days of hip hop, rap, you know, he was not immune from all of that culture pouring into his life. So I think he thought, you know, whoa, thug life, especially since he was a big old nerd, and this would be totally fun to be a tough guy. And when we got to the shoot, as soon as those handcuffs clinked, I just, oh my gosh, my heart is beating right now, just sort of going back to that moment. And he was okay, but then soon he was like, can you take these off? Like, it just wasn't fun. It was very uncomfortable. They kind of hurt. And I was like, take it off. And so we took the cuffs off, and he played with the photographer, who was one of the best people I know. And he got us both calmed down. But I just never shook that. And I remember saying to the photographer, I can't help but think, if Jay ends up in handcuffs for real one day, will he remember that it was his mother who first put him in handcuffs?
As we review the stories in just the past decade of young Black boys being killed by police or people who claim to be acting in the interests of security, where the justification is that the boys were mistaken for being older than they were. I mean, this is a list of boys, including Tamir Rice in Cleveland, who was 12 years old, mm-hmm. playing in a park when police shot him. How does that understanding of how white America views black children, how does that resonate with you today as a mother? And you're a grandmother at this point, too. Mm-hmm. How does that land?
The same way it landed when I was the sister of a brother, of a baby brother in the 60s. I mean, we have never not been terrifying. It's always not our potential as human beings, but our potential as criminals that people see first. And that has not changed. And ironically, you know, there's this saying, you become what you fear. And I really think it's not the fear of black boys in particular being criminals. It's the fear of the righteous anger that black people feel being turned against whites. I mean, the fear is in them, right? And it's being projected onto our children. That's what's happening, and that's not going to get shook loose until the guilt of what has happened to black people in America is owned by whites. I mean, there's got to be a boogeyman, and it can't be them. So, boom, you know, black men are it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Des Cooper. She has a recent essay available at the Rumpus called Arrest Record. Des, given all you know about how society works for black boys and what you wrote, you still hold on to some optimism that the structure and people in positions of power will come to view and treat Jay and other sons justly and fairly, perhaps even when that's not actually the case. What do you think it is within us that makes us need to trust other people?
I'm not sure it's even fair characterization for me to say I believe it will change, because everything has taught me that it's probably not, and it's going to be a long time more coming. I think, though, there is the hope of transcendence. The hope is that a few of us will get through, and a few more and a few more. You know, I don't want to sound heroic, but it's almost the Harriet Tubman hope. It's like, okay, I'll go back one more time, and this time it'll be solved. So I think that that is more the hope. I mean, you can't give birth to someone and then give up hope. I mean, you can, but that is not what is in me as a parent. You know, I think immediately you start living for the future when you give birth to someone. You immediately start trying to figure out a better path for them in particular and for the world in general, for them to have it better. So I think that's what keeps it fighting. And then ironically, they keep coming. So you got grandchildren. I mean, how many of us have said, well, at least let me live to see, you know, my kid graduate. And then you go, well, let me live for marriage. Then let me live for my grandchildren. Right. Then let me see them graduate, you know. So you never want to stop, you know. I mean, that's a human survival mode. That's what we do as humans, is that we want to be here for the next and the next. And black families are the same as any family in that regard. So the hope is not really so much like I'm gonna make a magical wish or unicorns or rainbows or even prayers to heaven that things are going to change soon or in my lifetime. It's that they're here and I care and I love so fiercely that I will get up every day and pray that it will be different through my actions. You know, through my actions, something will change. You know, now we wake up and we see those young people in the streets. And I will say it's been quite a funk to experience a pandemic of disease and a pandemic of racial unrest at the same time. But for the racial unrest, I think I would have been far less hopeful, because the pushback has been so enormous and so broad that it's make me feel like, oh, okay. You know, we really aren't by ourselves, and we really aren't going to let leadership get by with this. And we really are going to address some really deep-seated issues. And I know this isn't going to be a seismic leap, but it already has been seismic. It's just that we have so far to go that it's just the beginning. But to go from everything's A-okay to we should rename our schools and our hospitals and we should rethink about history and we should take away racist depictions on our breakfast products. You know, that's a pretty big awakening. So I'm hoping it will continue.
Do you feel like you've come to a different place in how you coexist with your worry for him?
No. So we are quarantined together here in Virginia.
You and Jay. Yeah.
Yeah. And so on top of all this, we've watched Black men being murdered together and the response to that every day, all day, because we're quarantined and there's really nothing else to focus on. And I've watched his very sweet demeanor get sullen and quiet, him disappear in his room. And I worry about his mental health. One day he said, you know, I'm going for a drive. And I literally wanted to jump up and say, no, I'll take you. But I couldn't. Someone's got to stay with my parents. And then I wanted to say, well, don't go right now. It's too close to dark. I mean, I was literally in the middle of this saying, no, my baby is going to get hurt. Don't go out there.
Yeah.
So no, it's the same from the beginning. It's worse now because I can't control him.
You started a Facebook group in the middle of all the protests surrounding George Floyd's murder. And the name of the group is How We See Us. It is the most lovely roll of pictures of Black men and boys just in their lives as seen by their families and their friends. Could you talk a little bit about starting the page?
You can't see me, but I'm grinning from ear to ear. Like when I just think of some of the pictures that are on that page.
They're just so lovely.
It's just boys and men and fathers doing what they do. They're like falling asleep with a baby slobbering all over their stomachs. And they're laughing on the Detroit Zoo train. And they're
karaokeing in the car with their daughters. And, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like, where do we ever see this? Especially if you're not already tied to African Americans and their families. Like, if it's not showing up in your feed, where would you actually ever see that? You wouldn't see it anywhere. You know, we show up when there's trouble. And so I just wanted to have a page where we could just post what our real lives look like, and they are not 24 hours of stress and violence and gnashing of teeth and wailing. You know, we're living and we're enjoying our children and we're enjoying our families. We are enjoying our men. They love us and we love them. And it's very hard to even keep that in mind as Black people sometimes. So I just wanted to have a place where that's clear.
Des Cooper, thank you so much for the many, many things that you're putting out in the world, whether it's the pictures, the words, just all of it. And thank you for talking with us about what's going on with you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Writer and Michigander Des Cooper coming to us from her quarantine spot with her family in Virginia Beach.